You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast with a new episode released every single day. I'm Paul Stevenson, and I thank you, as always, for hitting play. Now, today's episode is a side two, but a slightly different side two, and I'll tell you why. It's because every question I put to this rock and roll star come from you. Yes, I'll give you some background. In January, I decided I was going to do a full album in February, basically listen to a whole album all the way through every single day throughout February, but I didn't want to listen to the classics, the obvious ones, Rumours, Appetite for Destruction, Exile on Main Street, that kind of thing. I wanted albums that had been maybe long lost forgotten ones, or ones that didn't get the credit they should have done at the time, or maybe albums from huge bands that everyone knows, but a little album that sneaked in between and didn't get much praise. So I put it out there. You guys all got in touch with so many different ideas and different albums and recommendations, and from that list I kind of compiled a 28-day list of albums to listen to throughout February, full album February and all that, and amongst that was one called Buffalo Skinners by Big Country. Now that was nominated by James Miller on Facebook, and when I put out the calendar for the month, so many people got in touch saying that that was a fantastic record, one that everybody has to listen to, and a definite forgotten gem. So that kind of got me thinking, that's interesting. And then when the day came along and I listened to it in full and everyone else listened to it in full, so many more people got in touch as well saying what a great record it was. So I looked into it a bit further and realised 1993 was when it was released, and actually March 1993 was when it was released. So this March is 30th anniversary of the record. So I've interviewed Big Country's Bruce Watson a number of times, especially for Vintage Rock Pod. He was one of the very first people I interviewed on the show back in 2020. It was episode 3. If you want to hear more stories from the band in the back catalogue, then check out episode 3 of Vintage Rock Pod. But I've also interviewed him a couple of times when I was on the radio as well. So it's not the first time I've spoken to Bruce. So with this in mind, I reached out to Bruce and said, look, do you want to come on the show? You can answer some questions from the fans, from the listeners, from the people on social media that want to know a little bit more about this record. They love this record. It's not a huge record that everyone knows. It's a kind of forgotten gem. Would you come on? And to my delight, he said yes immediately. So we set up a little Zoom call where I spoke to him from his house. He was just getting ready because they're out on tour now. So I put out a couple of questions on Facebook and asked people to get in touch with their questions. I invited you to give me questions to put to Bruce. So basically that's what I did, and so many people got in touch. 21 different people made comments and questions that I put to Bruce in this interview that you're about to hear. So thank you so much to everybody. I can't name you all now, but you will be named when I ask Bruce the question. Don't worry about that. So that's all to come. So I hope you do enjoy this chat with Bruce Watson, Big Country guitarist, who's going to dive deeper into this fantastic record. And first of all, though, if you haven't listened to the Buffalo Skinners yet, then please do so, because it was tremendous. For me, it was a real eye-opener. I know a lot about their 80s back catalogue, Steel Town, The Seer and The Crossing, all that sort of stuff. That's huge. Huge singles. Great, great band. I've lived in Scotland for 20-odd years, so very much on my radar. But the 90s stuff did certainly pass me by. I wasn't too aware of it. So I was really, really delighted when I found the Buffalo Skinners, and it is a top, top notch album. If you haven't listened to it yet, then please do give it a chance and definitely listen to this interview to get a bit more information about what happens behind the making of it. Now, we delve into individual songs and how they came around and lyrically and that sort of thing. We go about what happened before this album, so leading into it. We talk about the live stuff. We talk about the headspace for the band. We talk about the reasons why the American release was different to the UK release, and so much more as well. well. I hope you really enjoy this deep dive into the world of the Buffalo Skinners by Big Country. And as I said, all the questions and all the comments and everything come from you. And if you did send one in, then hopefully you'll get a nice name check too. So please do enjoy this interview with Big Country's Bruce Watson. So my first question then, Bruce, is from Richard Harrison. He said this: he felt that No Place Like Home was a step too far in the wrong direction after Peace in Our Time, but the Buffalo Skinners is a hard and heavy record, probably the best sounding Big Country album that captures the power of the band's legendary live performances. So take us back to those two albums before this one then that we're going to talk about. What was happening with the band on those previous albums, and why do you think that they didn't land as well as they should have?
No Place Like Home, which was album number five. Mark wasn't in the band at the time, our original drummer. although Mark actually played on the album, he came back and did it as a session. And it was kind of a little bit disjointed. Because Mark wasn't in the band, the songs were kind of written in various demo situations, and they were never really rehearsed as a band anyway. The album, it's not a bad album, but it sounds like it was recorded with, you know, by four or five different bands, you know. It was just a little bit disjointed. So that's probably the reason that the chaps, you know, a big fan of the album, you know. But when we did Buffalo Skinners, Mark was still not in the band. In fact, Mark never played on the Buffalo Skinners album, but that album was demoed with Tony, Stuart and myself actually sitting in a studio playing them together. And we've got Simon Phillips in to play drums on it, which he did in 2 days and did a fantastic job. And then after that, Mark came back to the band anyway. But I think that's the reason, you know, No Place Like Home, it was quite a disjointed. There was no cohesion, there was no continuity, just because the way it was written, basically, you know, and we didn't have Mark in the band, so it was a bit bitty.
So in terms of the time after that record, I mean, did the band split up at this point? Because the label had released you as well, hadn't they? So what was it that pulled you back together? What made you decide to go again and give it another go?
The band was always, well, for the first three albums, we were kind of a close-knit unit. And at one point, I think it was after album number four, which was Peace in Our Time, Stuart left the band and Mark decided to take on extra work. And then 2 weeks later, Stuart went, "Oh, I made a stupid mistake. I'm coming back to the band." And Mark had kind of booked himself out to work with people like Midge and Fesh and stuff like that. So, and obviously he couldn't let those people go down. So, you know, we were in a bit of disarray for a little while. We were kind of drummerless, you know, for a bit. So, I mean, that's the reason, I think. You know, I mean, Mark was such a big part of how we worked in the studio, and he was sorely missed, especially by me.
Indeed, indeed. Quick question that leads us on to something that John Clark said. He actually says Simon Phillips' drumming on the record is outstanding. What did he bring to the studio that was different to Mark?
A red drum kit. He was setting the kit up. We did it at Rack Studios. We produced it ourselves along with Chris Sheldon. And I remember Simon bringing his kit in. I can't remember if it was Yamaha, but it was beautiful red, bright fire engine red kit. And I went, "That's a beautiful kit, Simon." He went, "Yeah, I've got it to match my Ferrari." I went, "Yeah, right on, man." You know, he did the whole album. I sent him the demos, and basically the demos was drum machine that, you know, Stuart and I would program with a little drum machine. And so that's all we had for him to reference. And he came along and did the whole album in 2 days. And it's like, wow, you know. And then when Mark heard that, he went, "That's exactly what I would have played anyway. So, you know, give me my job back."
Fantastic. Thanks, man. You mentioned there about producing the record yourself. Again, this is something from Michael Saunders. He said, "The Buffalo Skinners is such a brilliant album, gritty, so well produced. It's my go-to album when I yearn to hear Stuart's voice and guitar." You guys, as you said, you produced the record yourselves. How was that as an experience for you then? Was it liberating getting to put your own ideas and things in?
Yeah, well, what happened is we got signed up to a label called Compulsion, which was run by Chris Briggs, who signed us originally to Phonogram. And when Chris came on board, you know, I would keep him up to date with the demo situation and send him, at that time it was cassettes and DATs, you know, and he kind of liked the way things were going. And we discussed it, and he said, well, maybe you've worked with Chris Sheldon before. We did a single with Chris Sheldon and Tim, it'll come to me anyway. And Tim was away working with Tears for Fears at the time. And Chris was still available. And I thought, well, you know, Chris was the engineer, but he was, you know, he was a great ideas guy as well. So Briggsy said, you know, like, maybe Chris and yourself co-produce it, you know, let's go in the studio, see what happens. And, you know, Chris Briggs would pop his head in every other day and say, no, this is sounding really great. This is, you know, just continue, you know. So it was great, you know, kind of co-producing it ourselves. And we knew Rack inside out anyway, because we'd done a lot of recording at Rack Studios, and we knew Mickey Most, and we felt comfortable there. And, you know, when we first started doing the crossing and the first recordings, obviously we needed help. We needed a producer or a referee or whatever. But by that point, you know, we were about six albums down the line, and we kind of knew what we wanted to do, you know. So Chris Briggs put a lot of trust in us.
Next question's from Gordon Skinner. He says, it's the noisiest album by the greatest rock band I've ever seen. A slightly different direction by Big Country. From start to finish, it doesn't stop. Now, was that predetermined that you'd went into the studio with the idea of making a big, hard, heavy, strong record?
Yeah, well, we knew it was going to be just the way the demos and the writing were going. Like I say, Tony, Stuart and myself were in the studio, a little place called Oreocraft in Dunfermline. And just really, you know, the three of us were hands-on, you know, writing together. So we kind of knew which way we were going. And for some reason, the songs were just getting heavier and heavier. And I don't know if that's because, you know, that was just after the whole grunge thing had happened, you know. And, you know, it's just the way we were at the time, you know. We were getting back into loud guitars again. And we were just rocking out, and you know, a lot of it was 4/4. You know, just the way it was, just the way we were writing back then. It was great.
Fantastic. Richard Metcalf. Then he says, the big man really let his guitar hero out on this one. Love this album, but Alone has a sad degree of poignancy given what happened later. Now, do you feel that way about the song as well, Bruce?
Well, Stuart always had a knack. The band would always do the music. And sometimes the music that we would do was very uplifting. And Stuart had this knack of putting really sort of dark lyrics to something that was really uplifting. You know, it was just a weird thing that he would do. He's done it quite a lot. So we kind of expected a lot of that kind of lyrics on the album. But it was just a thing Stuart did, you know. Sometimes his lyrics were, you know, a bit obtuse, fantasy. Some of them were black and white about, you know, things that were happening in the news at the time. Some of them were ideas from books, and then there'd be other things that, you know, whatever was in his head at the time, you know.
Here's one from Joe Kay, who's in Milwaukee. He says he's awful at interpreting lyrics. Selling America is such a brilliant track, but what is it about? What was Stuart trying to say on this one?
I haven't got a clue. I think he'd maybe been watching. There was a movie. It was a Sean Connery movie at the time. I can't remember what it was called now. But it was quite influenced by movies and books. Was it called Rising Sun or something like that? Sean Connery. I think it was called Rising Sun. I think it took a lot of inspiration for that movie.
There you go.
I can't tell you exactly word for word, sentence for sentence, what it's about.
It's just a great song. We'll leave it at that. Here's one that a lot of people have been in touch about. Stevie T, Nathan Fenton, Justin Keeney, and Marv from the podcast Pods Like Us. They all want to know why the superb title track wasn't included on the final album.
Because at that time, vinyl was still on the go. So you had so many minutes you could do on each side of the vinyl. And that's the reason that Buffalo Skinners wasn't on it, because it wasn't, even though it was the title track, it wasn't in keeping with the rest of the music. It's, Buffalo Skinners is a very slow acoustic sort of song, and we just felt that it wouldn't fit on the vinyl. But I mean, obviously it was on the CD and everything else that came out. But when you do a vinyl record, you're limited to time, obviously. Otherwise, the quality suffers. But we tended to do that with a few albums. The first album was The Crossing, and we had a song called Crossing, but we never put that on the album either, you know. So it was just one of those things that we tended to do.
Ah, interesting. So what is it about the title of that track then that lent itself to the album in itself, in its entirety?
Oh, we just thought about different album titles, and we looked at the titles of some of the songs that we'd recorded, and like I say, Alone, we didn't want to call the album Alone. And so we just kind of felt the Buffalo Skinners was a good title to go with for the album, just one that kind of stuck out, you know.
Definitely. Ned Itcham, he says his favourite track on the record is Seven Waves. That one was written by Bruce, I think. What's the story behind it? How did you come up with that one?
The music for Seven Waves, at the time, I was living on the coast. I was living practically next door to Manny Charlton from Nazareth. So Manny was helping me set up my studio at home. And he had obviously had a home studio as well. So I would go around to his place. And, you know, so I went out to Manny's one day, and he was working on my computer. And he blew it up. So while I was waiting for spare parts to come for this little computer that I had, he said, "Well, you know, just come in my studio." And I had ideas for some musical ideas I needed to get down fast, you know. So Manny says, "Right, come in here and start, you know, we'll start recording you." So Seven Waves was me and Manny kind of just working together. He engineered it and sort of co-produced the idea that I had and played a bit of slide on it. And we came up with it was my music, but Manny kind of got the best out of me. So I ended up just recording this track, which didn't have a title. I managed to sing a couple of melodies on the top of it that didn't mean anything, but they were just there for, they were just placeholders. And then I just did the usual, just took up to Stuart and went, "Yeah, that's great." And he took it away and put his lyrics there, you know, and so that's how Seven Waves came about.
Great stuff. Here's one from Paul Lewis and Mark Hay. They're both asking about The One I Love. They said it was released as a single in America, got a lot of airplay, charted quite high on the rock charts as well. But they both want to know why it wasn't released as a single in the UK or Europe.
Well, we were with Compulsion in the UK, and we were with Fox Records in America, as in 20th Century Fox side of a label. So, I mean, it happens a lot. If you're on one label in the UK, it doesn't mean to say you're going to be on the same label in America or even Europe. So they tend to just put out what they think is suitable for that territory. And they chose The One I Love. And you know, I was quite happy for that to come out as well, you know. I guess maybe they thought Alone might have been too heavy or whatever, but they went with that, and it did okay there.
Speaking of America, Carl Cusumano, apologies if I got that wrong, he says the US version of the record had the bass increased, which he says made the entire album sound so much better. He says listening to the US and the UK versions is a distinct difference. Why was that, yeah, Bruce?
The reason being the American release got released months later. There wasn't simultaneous, and I think, well, what was it, George Marino came in to remaster it for America, and the sound, if you play them, if you A-B them, play one of the songs back to back, it's quite evident that the US version, in my opinion, is far superior. It does sound a lot different, a lot. The mix is the same, it's the same master tapes, it's just been mastered differently. And I mean, I've noticed that quite a lot, especially way back in the 80s. You know, you get into a cab in America and the radio on, and I don't know if it's to do with EQ or compression. It just, American radio at that time sounded out of this world. It was amazing, you know.
Fantastic.
Maybe it's the difference between, I don't know, American engineers and British engineers. I don't know.
Well, the American one did a good job on that one then. Here's Eddie Dempsey. He says the 1993 gig in Dublin's Olympia was absolutely rocking. I mean, the place was vibrating. Did Big Country ever record a concert in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, there must have been some recordings, whether they got released or not, but there's probably been a few recordings that were made out there. Whether they were released or not, I don't know. I'm not sure. But you do a lot of radio stuff out there. You do a lot of gigs out there, and you kind of find out later that was recorded by, you know, whatever radio station. You never get to hear it because you moved out of that country and you've moved somewhere else. So I can't honestly answer that 100%, but I think there would have been.
Must be something somewhere. There's a lot of people talking about the live tour from this era as well, about how explosive it was, how loud it was. I've got Kenny Henderson said there, the live shows at this time were rocking. Long Way Home live at the Barrowlands is one of his life highlights. And Stephen Berlin said, he says, I saw Big Country 27 times with Stuart, and the best tour was the Buffalo Skinners one. Now, did you feel it yourselves? Was the energy really ramped up when you went out on stage during this era, during this time with these songs?
I tend to agree. I think the Buffalo Skinners, you know, apart from obviously the early days, but I think the Buffalo Skinners too. When Mark came back on board, it clicked again. And I just think that those are some of the best shows that we've ever done. At the time, we were doing a lot of the Buffalo Skinners album, as well as the earlier stuff as well. And they just seemed to fit, you know. And just having Mark back was an absolute joy. I just felt like we were firing on all four cylinders again.
The band back in business.
It's your drummer that makes the band, you know. Yeah.
Absolutely. Justin Keeney, he says that this was your best album for me and seemed to be a great period for the band. What's your favourite memory of this time?
Loads of great memories, you know. Well, obviously, doing the album, even though it was Simon Phillips and not Mark, but actually doing the album. And we just seemed to be on the road quite a lot. We toured America as well on that album, and we haven't really toured America since the early days. So we did a lot of tours, America, Canada, and we were in Europe a hell of a lot. It was just one of those albums that we just got given a great opportunity to tour the world practically, you know. The touring side of things was great.
Yeah, always is. Andrea Thigpen, she just wanted to say, tell Bruce he rocks, loved them from the beginning, was a dream come true to meet him and Mark, love from Canada, which is a really nice thing to say from Andrea. But you have roots in Canada as well, don't you?
Yeah, I was born in Timmins, Ontario, way back in 1961. I was actually born in the same town that Shania Twain was born, but obviously, you know, probably 20 years apart.
So what brought you back to Dunfermline then?
The Queen Mary.
Fair enough.
My parents emigrated, obviously, but my father was a gold miner out there. I just don't think my mother took to it, you know. So they stuck it for a couple of years, then came home on the Queen Mary, so... And I ended up back in Dunfermline. So I'm the only Canadian in a family of Scottish people.
There you go. And a couple of off-topic questions that came in too. Mike Lamens, he said, The Seer, the title track, how did Kate Bush come to sing on it? And did you get to work with her in the studio at all?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of discussed it with Robin Miller, who was the producer at the time. And we'd been listening to a lot of Kate Bush stuff, and I think that it was The Dreaming we were listening to quite a lot. And The Seer was kind of had that same sort of vibe as one of the songs in The Dreaming. And we were all sitting, you know, probably Kate Bush could get Kate Bush on this. It's, you know, it's a laugh over the dinner table. And Robin, you know, I know Kate Bush, and I know people that work, you know, or people or whatever. And, if you don't ask, you don't get. So Robin sent up a cassette to Kate Bush, and she agreed to do it. And she turned up at the studio at the power plant in Willesden. And she was in the studio for 5 hours. And we could not believe what she was doing. She completely rearranged all these vocal parts. And we were just blown away, just watching her doing it. We were in the control room upstairs looking down, and she was in the studio. And it was just absolutely amazing, you know. And I kind of felt a shame when the album came out, because Robin Miller did a great mix of the record. And the song, The Seer, was almost like a duet with Stuart and Kate, the way it was done. But the album got remixed later on, and I think they kind of dumbed their vocals down a bit. And I knew that The Seer was almost going to be a single, but it was like 7 minutes long or something. And the label tried to edit it down, and the edits just wouldn't work. And then obviously it got remixed. So, but, you know, I think a lot more could have been made of Kate's vocal during the new mix. But, you know, it's sometimes these things are out of your hands. But it was just amazing, you know, watching and listening to her working. Absolute genius.
100% agree. And what last one from Michael McCauley. He says, Steel Town is my favourite Big Country album. How come I can't find any demos of the tracks released at all, not even crappy hissy cassette versions?
Because there was only crappy hissy cassette versions ever demoed. Because The Crossing was quite successful and all those songs were written years in advance. Once we'd done The Crossing, once we'd done all the touring, it's the record company said, well, now basically time to do your second album. And it's like, oh God, we haven't written anything. So the four of us ended up using a rehearsal room up in Edinburgh. And we never demoed anything for that album. But all we had was a cassette, a little boombox kind of thing. And we stuck that in front of Mark's bass drum. And we used that to get the ideas down. And we never went into a studio to demo any of the songs. We ended up just taking all the ideas across the Sweden, across the Polar, which was ABBA's studio, and we just worked on them in the studio. So we never demoed anything for Steel Town.
Well, there you go. So thank you very much for chatting about these albums, and your music's fantastic. You're a busy boy as always. I've caught you just before you go back out on tour. There's big touring plans again for this year, March, April, May, early June. It's the 40th anniversary of The Crossing. So tell us about these shows.
Well, like you say, it's the 40th anniversary of The Crossing. We're going to go out, we do the album in its entirety, but we don't do it in sequential order. And obviously we play a lot of other songs as well, so it doesn't make sense to do it in sequential order, because it just, the set list wouldn't be dynamic if we were to do it like that. So we're going to go out, and we've got our special guest is Kirk Brandon, who's bringing out Spear of Destiny. So that's going to be great fun, because Kirk and I go back a long way. So, yeah, I mean, it's you know, I think people are going to come out, and they're going to see two good bands. It's going to be a great night, great tour. And like I say, you'll get all the songs from The Crossing, plus a lot more.
Fantastic. And you're right across the UK on all these dates. I think there is some are sold out already. There are some tickets available for some venues. So what's the best way to find out about more information on this?
I don't know how you go about doing this nowadays. I think you go online and buy tickets. I just go online, I guess, and buy a ticket, come along and have a damn good time. Well, I'm just getting myself ready. We're going out to Holland as well in a couple of weeks. We're going out there for a week. We've got a week's worth of sellout shows out there to do. We've been trying to get out there for ages, but because of the COVID thing, they kept getting put back. So we're now getting to get out there, and hopefully we'll get out to Germany as well, get around Europe at some point. But it's the UK we're going to do first.
Absolutely. And you've got some festival dates in the summer as well. And I noticed that you've got an interesting one. I've never heard of this festival, The Devil's Arse. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, that's The Devil's Arse. It's my son, Jamie, that's in the band, he keeps creasing up about that one. Either. But what is it? They've been playing in a curry house out there. I've never even heard of the place, but it sounds like it's going to be great.
Absolutely does. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you again, Bruce. Thank you so much for your time chatting about Buffalo Skinners and answering all those questions for me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you.
The brilliant Bruce Watson there. A big thank you to everybody that got in touch and sent me a question or a comment about the album, which we turned into questions. It was fantastic to put all those to Bruce, and he really, really kindly accepted the invitation to come on and talk more about a fantastic record. Now, the band are out on tour. If you haven't got tickets yet, then do check local venues near you, because it's a fantastic 40th anniversary of the Crossing tour that they are doing. Just as Bruce said, definitely worth checking that out. And as I said as well, I've interviewed Bruce for Vintage Rock Pod earlier on in the series. Very, very early on. Episode 3, in fact. You can go back to, I think it was October 2020. So please do find that out. And I've given that a listen as well. It would be wonderful if you did. Anyway, that's it for this week's big interview show then. I hope you enjoyed that. I've got more big guests coming your way every single Monday. Big interview shows every single Monday. I've got another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer already in the can to bring you. A lead singer of a brilliant 60s, 70s kind of American rock and roll band. That's coming up very soon as well. And I've got some British rock and rollers coming in the pipeline as well. So much good stuff. Plus, a daily episode is released on the Tuesday through to Sunday, short 5-minute episodes where we talk about what happened on this day in rock. I call those This Day Rock. So please do subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod. Find it on your podcast app or player of choice. Hit subscribe and you'll get a brand new episode every single day from Vintage Rock Pod. And while we're speaking about subscribing, get onto YouTube as well and you can see the full video I did with Bruce talking about all this sort of stuff, as well as all the other interviews I do in short clips and everything else. It's all on the Vintage Rock Pod channel on YouTube. Hit subscribe, watch the videos, don't skip the ads. That'd be fantastic. Anyway, I'll be back same time next week to do it all over again on the big interview show, and I'll be back tomorrow with This Day Rocks. But until then, take care.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.